Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
If we have a conversation about healthy foods and they don't involve conversations about capitalism, then I'm just not interested in them anymore.
Today's show features an interview with Marcia Chatelain. She's been researching the role that Black-owned fast food franchises have historically played in Black communities. We check in with Puerto Rican farmers 1 year after Hurricane Maria, with Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach. And we do some pickling with Chef Daniel Orr. That's all coming up, so stay with us. It's been a year since Hurricane Maria swept over Puerto Rico, claiming nearly 3,000 lives and destroying farms all over the island. In a recent episode of the NET Nebraska podcast, On the Table, Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains how Puerto Rican farmers are recovering with the assistance of federal disaster relief programs found in the Farm Bill.
Maria was a Category 4 storm when it struck Puerto Rico. The wind screamed through the trees at speeds over 150 miles per hour. Farmer Luis Pinto describes what it was like the night of the storm.
Eso sonaba como una película de terror. Y cuando entró, que entró como a las 5:30, y eso era.
It was like a horror film. You felt it like the hurricane was crying.
To get a first-hand view of how federal relief programs came into play after Maria, On the Table teamed up with FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and sent freelance journalist Allison Keyes to talk with farmers. That's where she met Pinto, who grows plantains near Yabacoa, about an hour southeast of San Juan.
He's 63 years old. He's been a farmer for more than 43 years, and he's been through hurricanes before. I mean, he survived hurricanes Hugo and George, and his crops were devastated then, but he says this time it was really, really rough.
I didn't sleep at all that night, but when I saw the destruction, I just cried. But I said, the show must go on.
You could actually see the pain in his face. Plus, he says between cattle, roads, fences, and plantains, he lost almost $300,000.
The federal Farm Bill authorizes a whole host of programs designed to intervene when a storm hits, or a drought, or wildfire. What Keyes heard in Puerto Rico was that some direct federal programs quickly provided things like livestock feed, while money processed through local officials trickled out to farmers. For instance, an insurance payment for Pinto's farm didn't arrive from the Puerto Rico Department of Agriculture for 9 months. Here's the U.S. territory's Ag Secretary, Carlos Flores.
There is no plan in the world to that type of disaster.
There was a plan on paper for the 2017 hurricane season, but when Maria hit, there are no phones, there's no electricity, there was no mail, there was no transportation, and people weren't expecting the entire island to be affected. So in response to the farmers' complaints about the slow insurance payments, he says, frankly, they did better than other insurance companies.
If you ask today how is the balance of other insurance in Puerto Rico, we are the only one that had paid already 95%.
While that program is administered by local officials, the money comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture via the Federal Crop Insurance Corporation.
That fund had about $5 million to start paying farmers. Then it needed to get more money from the federal government because it was running out because so many people needed help.
Hurricane Maria threatened many farmers' livelihoods. Rafael Lopez nearly lost his life. The dairy farmer from northwest Puerto Rico was rushed to the hospital with leptospirosis, a bacterial infection that ran rampant after the storm.
It is very hard to sit down with your daughter and said, if I am not alive tomorrow, you have to do this and that and that.
And he says, you know, he agrees with a lot of other people that think that the death toll was not accurately reported at first.
At the same time I was in the hospital, two other guys had the disease. They died. They were younger than me. Now that we are ready to celebrate the 1 year of Maria, honestly, I am stressful.
It's actually more than stressful for him and the other people I talked to. Everyone on the island is still terrified, right? And Lopez, like a lot of other people, watches the Weather Channel every day to see what's going to happen next.
Congress approved an extra $2.4 billion to help farms recover from 2017 disasters, but not just in Puerto Rico. It's also marked for Texas, Florida, and western wildfires. So that money has a lot of ground to cover. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
That story was produced in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, an independent nonprofit news organization. You can hear more about how farms were impacted by Hurricane Maria on the NET Nebraska podcast, On the Table. Find it on iTunes and SoundCloud. For those involved in the good food, real food, and local food movements, it's easy to write off fast food, either because it's not good for you, it's not good for the environment, or because the industry doesn't pay its workers a living wage. Or if you happen to be well off, maybe it's just not classy enough for you. But through the second half of the 20th century, African American communities and even civil rights organizations saw fast food franchising as a way to bring jobs and money into Black communities. It's hard to imagine today that a McDonald's franchise could ever be seen as an engine of Black socialism. But Marcia Chatlin, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University, reminds us that African American communities continue to be constrained, and fast food has been one way to make things work. Dr. Chatlin's first book is called Southside Girls, Growing Up in the Great Migration. She's currently finishing up a book about the relationship between Black communities and the fast food industry called From Sit-In to Drive-Thru. Earth Eats Associate Producer Alex Chambers spoke with her via Skype.
Your first book was about the Chicago end of the Great Migration through the lens of Black girls. Was there some sort of progression that took you from that to this?
You know, the kind of bridge I often talk about in terms of my two projects is that after I finished up in graduate school and I was traveling between Chicago and Oklahoma City, where I first started teaching, and then Washington, D.C., I would spend a lot of time in my hometown of Chicago. And I always thought it was really fascinating the number of cultural institutions or various activities that I encountered that were underwritten by the local chapter of the National Black McDonald's Operators Association. And I remember in high school, the first time I ever read anything about the Great Migration was part of a History Quiz Bowl TV show that I was on through my school. And I remember that it was the McDonald's operators that had paid for the prizes for the competition. And so it always was this kind of issue in the back of my head in terms of what does it mean for an organization of Black franchise operators to not only have kind of so many footprints in a city, but what does it mean for the relationship between communities of color and fast food when there are these franchise owners who are kind of like local heroes or ambassadors or well-known entities.
I never thought about the fact that the rise of fast food happened right at the same time as the civil rights movement was sort of taking off.
Right. So one of the things I talk about in the book, the first chapter looks at doing a critical race history of fast food and thinking about fast food and the housing market as being very similar, where there's some of the politics of redlining, there's the federal infrastructure that's allowing a lot of whites who are either leaving the military and using the GI Bill for business loans or who are entering franchising and they're able to be successful. So franchising kind of grows up in the suburbs and becomes very popular in terms of highway transportation, right? And all of these structures are so bound by racial constructs of where funding is allocated and where it's not, who has access to houses in the suburbs and cars to drive along the interstates. And then there's this massive shift in the 1960s after 1968, where there are all of these uprisings after the assassination of Martin Luther King, their various hot summers, and one of the most consistent refrains, or rather responses, to uprisings is that poor communities need their own businesses. African Americans really should buy into some of the black capitalism rhetoric that reemerges in this time, and this is going to be the way forward, business. And the business that is kind of ready to pounce is the franchise industry. When gas prices started to soar, and when more and more suburban families were being discerning about how they spent money or whether they would want to fill up the car and expend gas to go to a fast food restaurant, the fast food industry really saw the inner city as the place to grow because it was a larger consumer base that walked to stores. And they also knew that putting in black franchise owners would ingratiate them to the community. And one of the things that I think is really important to note when we were talking about these things is that, you know, I don't think anyone at that moment could anticipate the size and the consequences of the fast food industry when they're trying to bring it into communities in the 1960s and 70s. But by the 1980s, it becomes very clear that there's some very complicated consequences as a result of this, but this relationship is at that point 20 years old. And so you have this kind of brokering between major civil rights organizations, federal subsidies, and then a fast food industry that is just trying to gain as much ground as possible.
Can you talk about those consequences that were unforeseen, that it was really, I think, are starting to become clear more, you're saying, in the 80s?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's interesting. When I'm looking at the early conversations about fast food, some of the critiques of the mainstream fast food industry is that, okay, you know, we really need to have our own black-owned franchises. And so there's these attempts to create these companies that are considered authentically black franchises. And they're not able to compete with the wealth and the size of some of these other major ones like your McDonald's, your Kentucky Fried Chicken, your Burger King. But initially, the critique or the resistance to fast food was, will this really provide all of the things that it's promising our community in terms of wealth and investment opportunities? And if it's not, then we have to build our own fast food. But there wasn't a real kind of concern about it. This idea of a McJob that is low wage, you don't have the right to organize, that it's really physically taxing, that doesn't kind of enter the conversation again until the 80s. And so the critiques that we have today of the fast food industry, they are slow to develop. And I think part of the reasons why some of those critiques aren't leveraged is because people actually think it's not a bad idea, that it could actually be a legitimate source of economic development and renewal because the industry in many ways was still growing as well.
So I'm curious, was there a complicated conversation going on around, well, okay, we've got these McDonald's available to us as a way of sparking the economic engine of the community, but we're, it's still, you know, it's a franchise. It's owned by a corporation.
So in the early days of franchising, the post-1954 franchising moment that characterizes a lot of McDonald's growth and its leadership under Ray Kroc, you knew who your franchise owner was because they were actually required to work in the store. So there was a way that there was a real kind of personalization of the experience of going to a McDonald's or going to a Burger King or going to a Taco Bell that fades as the industry goes. But initially, people actually, they didn't leverage those kinds of critiques about kind of corporate power because there were many ways in which a franchise could still feel very familiar and connected to the community, if that makes sense, right? Like, there are some questions about, is our money going out of our community? But then there was also the sense that if we go to a black-owned McDonald's, we're still able to support our community in some ways because a large part of the culture of franchising in local communities in these early days was about philanthropy and a lot of being very present, you know, donating Little League uniforms and doing the college scholarships. And the African American franchise owners, I think, were particularly attuned to their kind of sense of responsibility and how people in the community would view them in terms of the resources that they could bring. So, you know, some of this corporate critique emerges, but not in the kind of robust ways that you would think in light of some of the other critiques that are being made about capitalism and systems. There's this anecdote in my book about how in April of 1969, Ralph Abernathy, who takes over Martin Luther King at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he goes on kind of a national tour to commemorate the first anniversary of King's death. And he stops a few weeks before his tour, he gives the speech and he says, "We don't need black capitalism, we need black socialism." And, you know, everyone's like, "What's going on here?" And so shortly after he gives the speech, he shows up at this McDonald's in Chicago and he picks up a check from a black franchise owner. And we could say that that act is, like, you know, rife with all sorts of contradictions and questions. But I think in that particular world, there is a way that the economic possibilities of African Americans are so constrained that they have to kind of fit to get some very basic needs met. So there is no kind of, there's no tension in the fact that, you know, Abernathy's calling for socialism and then his organization is very excited about franchise possibilities. And so I think that, you know, I write about critiques, but a lot of the critiques are about the extent to which McDonald's, particularly, because it's the first one that's doing what they called minority franchising, the critique is to the extent that they're going to be a citizen, not even like a question about their citizenship in inner city America.
What do you mean by the critique is that they're going to be a citizen? That it's about how involved the McDonald's is
yes.
going to be in the community.
Not if they should be here. It's like, well, how are you going to fit yourself into the things that this community needs and be part of it? There's another anecdote about Portland McDonald's, Portland, Oregon, and the local Black Panther Party is accused of bombing them. And one of the reasons that they are allegedly a target is because they won't donate to the breakfast program and they won't be a member of the community in a sense that, like, this is what you're supposed to do. If you're going to be here and if you're going to profit from us, there's got to be some exchange. And a lot of the strategy that the fast food industry has to figure out is how much do you concede to these demands? How much do you give in to these boycotts? Because they know that they're going to grow and they know that the inner city is incredibly profitable and this is a market they want to be in. But they also are very concerned about setting precedent. And so there's these different situations in which these protests, these boycotts of their stores emerge, and the boycotts are about the terms in which they are going to engage the community. Rarely are the protests about getting them actually out of the community.
Right, right. And to a certain degree, those protests do make a difference. Right. I mean, it seems like there is an effort by McDonald's to start to invest at a certain point in black ownership.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing. It's kind of the question of what's the goal. If the goal is more franchise owners, yeah, you can get more franchise owners. If the goal is to make sure that the franchisee is contributing, absolutely, you can get that. You know, I think that a lot of McDonald's success is predicated on this idea of knowing kind of when to get involved and when to step back and let franchise owners take the temperature of communities and figure out their relationships. But a lot of the philanthropy that is associated with McDonald's, the Ronald McDonald houses and all of these different efforts, a lot of these are done by franchise owners and not necessarily the corporation. And there's a reason for that. I think they learned very quickly that franchising works because basically someone else carries the water or takes on all the liability of your company for you. And part of what I chronicle in the book is that in the 60s and 70s, there are liabilities, quote unquote, of doing business in the inner city. There's the demands of the community, there are the expectations, and there's also some real structural issues in terms of the higher cost of doing businesses in communities that are poorer. And so all of those like issues, they are on the shoulder of the franchisee. And so a lot of what I talk about is this way that even within a system that allows for some African Americans to become wildly wealthy and to have a lot of influence and power, there are still these questions about equity and fairness, even within this system, because African Americans are ultimately constrained, whether they're constrained in terms of their consumer choices or they're constrained when they're doing business. These are the constraints that everyone is trying to negotiate and maximize. And I think that if there's a takeaway from my research, it's that, you know, what do people do with constrained choices? They make it work.
We've been listening to Alex Chambers interviewing Marcia Chatelain. After a quick break, we'll hear about her own relationship with fast food and her thoughts on the fight for 15. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Marcia Chatelain is an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University. Let's return to Alex Chambers' interview with Dr. Chatelain.
Did this, working on this, did this change your own relationship to fast food?
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up eating tons of fast food, and it's that kind of thing that's so interesting. You know, I don't eat as much of it now because I'm just older and my digestive systems don't work like they used to, but I will never say that I'm an anti-fast food person. I have concerns about some of the health consequences, and I have concerns about the working conditions. But I'm also, I think, increasingly just more sympathetic to the fact that the choices that people have are the choices they have, and that's fine. And I think I was maybe a little bit more compelled by some of the kind of conversations in the healthy food movement, but if we have a conversation about healthy foods and they don't involve conversations about capitalism, then I'm just not interested in them anymore. And I think it's kind of changed the ways that I think about how we solve problems around health and nutrition. And it was important for me to write a book about the fast food industry that wasn't about food, but about all of the other things that happens.
So did this lead you to any new thoughts about sort of current issues like the fight for 15, anything like that?
I think that in terms of labor and thinking about the concentration of fast food in certain communities and what a job means in some communities and what a job means in others, it just makes me think about all of the things, all of the arguments and all of the affective work of fast food writing itself within a civil rights context, and how that can be a very effective tool in resisting the demands of workers. I think about that a lot. Like, you know, I was talking to a franchise owner, and I visited one of his restaurants, and his manager says to me, you know, I'm one of the few people who is going to employ someone with a criminal record. And I give people a second chance, and people saying, this is like my ministry. We can write that off and say, okay, this person's just saying this, whatever. But I think that some people really do mean this, and some people really do see the jobs that they provide as doing something really powerful. I think the problem is that for people who are in that orientation, we have to help them understand what justice really looks like. And so it's this thing I often say to my students, like, we always think that advertising works on everyone but us because we're smarter than the advertising. But when we think about how this industry has created wealth that then helps pay for historically black colleges and universities to have scholarships, and then provides opportunities for sports, and then says, like, if you just keep on working at this industry, maybe one day you'll make it like I will. Like, even in my most cynical moments, I get how people are really moved by that. And the question is, for those of us who have a different vision of justice and opportunity, what are we going to provide that is as compelling and as effective so that people will believe us when we say that another world is possible?
That was Marcia Chatelain, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University. Her forthcoming book is called From Sit-In to Drive-Thru, Black America in the Age of Fast Food. She spoke with Earth Eats Associate Producer Alex Chambers. This time of year, I'm harvesting the last of the cucumbers and the peppers for my garden and thinking of ways to hang on to some of this late summer goodness. My favorite way to preserve these veggies is pickling. And it's so simple. You don't need to break out a canner. You don't need to make a huge batch. Just cover them in a hot vinegar salt brine and stick them in the fridge. Your cucumbers will stay nice and crisp since they don't go through a canning bath. And your peppers can range from a mild pepperoncini style to flaming hot. Chef Daniel Orr is here to walk us through the steps of his simple pickled peppers.
Today what we've done is we've got some habaneros as well as some banana peppers and some Tabasco peppers, and we're going to pickle them. And what you do is you just take some plain old white vinegar, distilled white vinegar. I'm going to add about a quarter of a cup of sugar, and that's going to tame that vinegar a little bit so it won't be quite so astringent. And then we're going to add just a little bit of salt. And again, all of these ingredients are natural preservatives. The vinegar is a preservative, the salt's a preservative, sugar is a preservative. I'm just going to bring that to a boil, and I'm going to add some spices. I've got some cinnamon sticks, I've got three star anise. I'm going to stuff these peppers into a nice ball jar, and I leave the habaneros whole, because if I was to cut them or pierce them, a lot more of the heat would come out. Then it's just going to make everything extremely hot, which is good for some people. I've got a couple slices of ginger I'm going to cram into that jar with the chilies, a few garlic cloves. Now my vinegar is boiling, and I'm going to ladle that onto those chili peppers, being careful that I get those cinnamon sticks and star anise pieces in there too, because they're going to continue to give off flavor as it sits and marinates. Let it cool down to room temperature, and then you can store these in the refrigerator. They'll last 6 to 8 months.
The vinegar is all you need to keep them preserved, and they'll taste better over time once the vinegar mellows and all the flavors meld together. We've got recipes on our website at eartheats.org. But if you don't see the kind of pickle you're looking for, grab a pickling book at the library or do a search online. The possibilities are endless. That does it for our show this week. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Marcia Chatlin. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I thank you for listening to Earth Eats. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and tell your friends about it. Maybe even leave us a review. We'd love to hear what you think of our show. You can also send us an email. Address it to eartheats@gmail.com. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com, and The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com.